arguably the second hottest race in the nation, Massachusetts, was the recipient of a Lindbach Award at the University of Pennsylvania in 1994. The awards, established in the name of the one-time president and principal owner of Abbott's Dairies, recognized distinguished teaching at Penn. Warren's recognition was noted in a 2005 Minority Equity Report. The document, still accessible online, was prepared by the Minority Equity Committee at Penn, which was established to, quote, undertake a systematic review of the status of minority faculty at the university, unquote. Table 11 of the report lists the names of the 112 Lindbach Award recipients from 1991 through 2004, eight of which appear in boldface italics. Three of those professors are African American. Three are Asian. One is Puerto Rican. And then there is Elizabeth Warren, William A. Schneider, Professor of Commercial Law. That Warren's name appeared in bold and italics designated her as a minority, just like the African-American, Asian, and Puerto Rican Lindbach recipients. Did Warren derive professional benefits from describing herself as a minority while she was at Penn and Harvard? That question continues to dog her candidacy. Her difficulty answering it has made it much more than the speed bump it might have been on a fast track to the seat once held by Edward M. Kennedy. For 9 years, while she was teaching at the University of Texas and Penn, Warren also listed herself as a minority in the Association of American Law Schools directory. Who provides such information to the academic reference? The faculty members themselves. Warren only stopped listing herself as such in 1995, just after she was hired by Harvard. But while she was at Harvard, the Crimson newspaper reported that the university's faculty included one Native American, Warren. And when she received tenure there, another Crimson story said she was the first woman with a minority background to receive tenure. All of which would be well and good if Warren could substantiate her claim of Native American ancestry, which is a federal requirement when universities report diversity data. Thus far, she has not. And by her own admission, her connection to American Indians is remote. Ever since this issue was raised by the Boston Herald in April, Warren has stumbled in her efforts to explain her claims of minority status. She initially sought to minimize the controversy by saying she had merely hoped, quote, that I'd get invited to some lunch group or some, maybe some dinner conversation, and I might find some people like me, people for whom Native American is part of their heritage and part of their hearts, unquote. That didn't silence the questions. Finally, after 5 weeks of trying to dodge the matter, Warren sought to quell the controversy with an email to supporters that read in part, quote, the people involved in recruiting and hiring me for my teaching jobs, including Charles Freed, Solicitor General under Ronald Reagan, who has publicly said that he voted for Scott Brown in 2010, have said unequivocally that they were not aware of my heritage and that it played no role in my hiring. Documents that reporters have examined also show I did not benefit from my heritage when applying to college or law school. As I have confirmed before, I let people know about my Native American heritage in a national directory of law school personnel. At some point after I was hired by them, I also provided that information to the University of Pennsylvania and Harvard. My Native American heritage is part of who I am, I'm proud of it, and I have been open about it, unquote. In a subsequent conversation with the Boston Globe's Brian McGrory, Warren insisted that the Harvard and Penn law schools hired her because of her scholarship and teaching abilities, not to increase the diversity of their faculties. She says she told the law schools she was Native American after she was hired, but she has not asked the law schools to release hiring records that might substantiate her claim. That her opponent, Republican Senator Scott Brown, has kept up the pressure is no surprise. Quote, this goes right to the integrity and character of a person, Brown has said. When you check that box, you're getting benefits for people who have historically been discriminated against, unquote. He raises a legitimate point. The silence thus far from those minorities who are the intended beneficiaries of affirmative action, is curious. If and when they demand to know whether Warren played the Native American card inappropriately, this issue could go from curiosity to deal breaker. I suspect I'm dead to Senator Warren for having written this. Not long after CNN debuted my program on Saturday mornings, an acquaintance of my wife reached out to me and, unsolicited, offered to put me together with Senator Warren. The intermediary was a woman with impressive credentials who had worked in a senior advisory capacity to Warren. Quote, was I interested in paying a call on her on Capitol Hill and maybe doing an interview, unquote. Well, of course. I remember that I followed up unsuccessfully, as did my producer, TC. But nothing ever came of the overture. I'm sure that's because somebody on the senator's staff put both our names in a search engine and found this column. I have great respect for Warren's intelligence and abilities as a retail politician, although I'm not convinced her progressivism can be sold nationally. Time will tell. Go on YouTube and watch her 2011 seemingly spontaneous "You Didn't Build It" speech at what looks like a coffee klatch in Andover, Massachusetts, and you can't help but be impressed by her ability to communicate on her feet. In fact, when President Obama tried to replicate that mantra during his 2012 campaign, he couldn't, not even working with a script. So she has some real, raw political talents honed, I am sure, by utilizing the Socratic teaching method in Ivy League law school classrooms. But this aspect of her resume, about which I wrote, remains a blemish. She held herself out and was recognized as being a minority faculty member. Until and unless her employment files are released, I think it's fair to assume she made her minority status known to the schools at the time of her hire. Is this a deal breaker to her advancement? Only if minority groups to whom her identification could have been detrimental make it an issue, not conservative outlets. By the way, we tried to book Warren for both my SiriusXM and CNN programs when she was in the midst of a publicity tour for her 2017 book, This Fight Is Our Fight. No luck. Like I said, dead. Zeppelin Communication Breakdown, Philadelphia Inquirer, November 25, 2012. David Petraeus, Lance Armstrong, Led Zeppelin. All my heroes are falling. The first two have gotten enough attention, so let me tell you a story about the third. Led Zeppelin will be recognized with a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts next weekend, which comes on the heels of the band's new concert movie, Celebration Day. The film was recorded in 2007 when the band reunited for its first headline show, a tribute to Atlantic Records founder Ahmet Erdogan. 18,000 lucky fans saw the performance at London's O2 Arena. 20 million other requests for tickets were denied. Zeppelin was one of those bands whose liner notes I studied in my suburban bedroom in the 70s, but I never got to see them perform before their career was cut short by the death of drummer John Bonham in 1980. That's why I was elated when they reunited 5 years ago with Bonham's son, Jason, playing in his stead amid talk that a tour would ensue. But the tour never happened. So the closest I've ever gotten to the band was last month when I attended the premiere of Celebration Day at the Museum of Modern Art in Manhattan. The screening was followed by a news conference with the band, Robert Plant, Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones, and Jason Bonham. A journalist a few rows in front of me asked the band about rehearsing for 6 weeks just to play one concert. It struck me as a circuitous way of asking about the possible tour that was on everyone's mind, and there were a few murmurs in the audience suggesting that the reporter had identified the elephant in the room. But the band reacted as if he had just told the emperor he had no clothes. The only answer came from lead singer Plant, who called the reporter a schmuck. It didn't sound as if he were kidding. A question or two later, I tried to introduce a little levity by saying I wanted to follow up on the question that was asked by the schmuck. No one laughed. I then congratulated the band on the release of the movie, which I said was terrific. I was very reverent. But, I said, I doubted that it would quench the thirst of fans who want to see Led Zeppelin in the flesh. In response, one of my heroes started making a snoring noise. The rest sat in stony silence. plant glared at me. Finally, after a few pregnant moments, John Paul Jones said softly, "Sorry." They hadn't refused to answer the question so much as they'd completely been dismissive of it. I sat down a bit chagrined, though I was heartened when a reporter from CNN followed up on my question, as did the legendary classic rock DJ Carol Miller. Neither got more of an answer. And there was further proof that this was the most important question in the room when both Rolling Stone and the New York Times focused on it writing about the movie launch. Leaving the news conference, I asked my field producer, Paul Loricella, what had just happened. "Wow," he said, "their contempt for that question was palpable. Shouldn't they be grateful that we still care about them? Shouldn't they be dragging their 60-year-old butts on stage before Jason Bonham has grandchildren?" Former Philadelphia DJ Denny Somach, the author of Get the Lead Out, How Led Zeppelin Became the Biggest Band in the World, was also in the room. I later asked him whether he thought the band had played its last live show. "I don't think they have," he said. "I think they're looking at what the Rolling Stones are doing, playing multiple dates in a few cities. I know for a fact that Jimmy Page is sitting at home playing his guitar and waiting for Robert to call." If Somach is right, the band might indeed give the public what it wants. Just don't ask them about it unless you want to be treated like a schmuck. Nobody withstands scrutiny anymore. Generals, athletes, rock stars. Maybe they never could. Maybe it's time to stop scrutinizing them and just appreciate their talents. In October of 2014, liberal Paul Loricella and I returned to Manhattan for another Zeppelin-inspired event. It was Paul's birthday, and I took him to a New York Times Times Talk featuring Robert Plant. I'd been to a few Times Talks, and they're terrific opportunities to get up close to cultural icons in a beautiful setting inside the Times building on 41st Street. I once saw the entire cast of Breaking Bad with another friend, Greg Stocker, one memorable night in this same setting. Plant had recently released the album Lullaby and the Ceaseless Roar and was interviewed by the Times' chief pop music critic, John Pareles, in front of a live audience of about 300 people. Well, Pareles didn't have the temerity to ask Plant about a possible Led Zeppelin reunion, even though it was on everyone's mind. And when the audience was invited to ask questions, it looked like none of us was going to confront the elephant in the room either. Having been famously smacked down by the entire band, as noted in this column, I had no interest in moving from my seat. But then, the final questioner, a fan who looked to be about 13 years old, asked the burning question on all of our minds. He indelicately did what all the adults were afraid to do, asking Plant, quote, "What is your relationship with Jimmy Page, and will you ever perform with him?" Surprisingly, Plant didn't seem agitated at this young fan and gave a thoughtful answer as well as a little advice and encouragement. He said things like, "You haven't felt this yet, but you might like somebody today and it might be difficult later on down the line." And, "Very good question. And you brought the house down. Well done. Nobody we knew asked you to say that, did they?" It was the lecture equivalent of Plant finishing the evening with Stairway. By the way, if you want to watch me ask the band about reuniting as described in the original column, you can view it on YouTube. The Teacher Who Opened a Mind, Philadelphia Inquirer, June 9, 2013. It's the time of year when our attention turns to graduates and their commencement speakers, but at a lunch with a friend last Friday, our conversation was about the often unacknowledged the teachers for whom we're grateful. I said I'd been fortunate. My list is long, a product of sound K-12 education in the Central Bucks public schools, followed by 4 years at Lehigh University and three more at Penn Law. There are so many to whom I owe so much, but one in particular, David Curtis Amidon, Jr. Truth be told, I was admitted to Lehigh as a legacy by virtue of my father and brother having received degrees before me. Before I arrived on campus, a fraternity brother of my own brother recommended that I use an elective to, quote-unquote, take anything taught by Professor Amidon. So sound was the advice that I ended up taking a course with him every single semester, 8 different enrollments. I've never read so much nor thought so deeply. Professor Amidon's reading list was enough to bankrupt you in the university bookstore. It was nothing for him to require the reading of a half dozen books per semester. The payoff for me came in the form of an academic awakening. My subpar SATs were forgotten when 4 years later I graduated Phi Beta Kappa, largely due to his tutelage, and was accepted at an Ivy League law school. What I didn't tell my friend at lunch is that a few years had passed since I'd spoken to my mentor. So I called him that very afternoon and learned from his wife, Anne, that she'd been meaning to reach out to me. Professor Amidon is recovering from a stroke and is also dealing with the debilitating effects of diabetes at a rehab facility in the Lehigh Valley. Last Saturday, I visited unannounced. Amidon will soon be 78. Despite the physical setbacks, his mind remains razor sharp. I turned down the Fox News in his room so that we could have a political conversation of our own and took note of the loss of his trademark beard. He'd always looked like Marx while speaking like Lincoln. The first sign that he hadn't missed a beat came when an orderly walked into the room to check on him. My professor introduced the man to me by name, adding that he hailed from Cameroon and was desirous of being a doctor. That's pure Amidon. See, the first day of class was always a treat. He'd slide his finger down the roster and proceed to tell each student more about their ethnicity and hometown than any of us knew ourselves. This was pre-Google. He could do that just by studying a surname. Ethnicity and genealogy mattered to him, and his interest was infectious. He was such a revered figure at Lehigh that they created a special platform, the Department of Urban Studies, consisting of one faculty member, him. And when he retired in 2008, after more than 40 years of instruction, so too did the department. I used to access his office after hours in room 358 of Chandler Ullman Hall, circa 1883, via a rickety wooden stair, to find him always ensconced amid his books, which were stuffed floor to ceiling, each acting as a sponge for the aroma of his cigars. But class is where he shone. Actually, professor doesn't fully describe him. He was a lecturer in the finest sense of the word, and each hour-long assemblage was a command performance. 30 years later, I can still recall the registrar's numbered listing of his courses, such as U.S. 363, which was a class called Philadelphia, Development of a Metropolis. This was no recap of our founding fathers. We read George Lepard's 1844 novel, The Monks and Monk Hall, 582 pages, and E. Digby Baltzell's Philadelphia Gentleman, among others. And a class trip via a van he drove one Saturday morning bypassed the Betsy Ross House and the Liberty Bell in favor of a stop at Laurel Hill Cemetery to read tombstones of prominent Philadelphia families. Lunch was at the famous 4th Street Delicatessen, where, in a second-floor room, proprietor David Auspitz was our guest lecturer about the city's modern political scene. My later friendship with Auspitz is something else for which I thank Amidon. Quote, I feel like a spectator now, unquote, Amidon said from his hospital bed last Saturday. Quote, I can't stir things up the way that I used to, unquote. He'd done plenty of that. Amidon himself had a personal political transformation from a frisbee-throwing 60s leftist to a 1980s conservative. I knew him only in the latter stage. In a freshman seminar, Paleo and Neoconservatives, he had us reading William F. Buckley's God and Man at Yale and George Gilder's Wealth and Poverty while studying the Laffer Curve. I know we haven't voted the same way in the last two presidential elections, and I told him I suspected that disappointed him. He would hear none of it. Quote, I'm disappointed that you would think I would be disappointed, unquote, he assured. We had a few laughs, shared our concerns about Syria, and found common ground in the foreign policy edicts of Ron Paul. Both of us fear foreign entanglements and worry that our interventions make us less safe. Amidon was secretary of the Lehigh faculty when I graduated in 1984, and in that role he signed my diploma. How appropriate. Quote, this was a lift, unquote, he said when, after more than an hour, I stood to leave. He was speaking for both of us. Sadly, Professor Amidon passed on September 23, 2016, at age 81. When Lehigh distributed word of Amidon's passing, an alumni publication noted that in 1977, he'd been recognized with the university's Stabler Award for Excellence in Teaching and how his out-of-the-way office, quote, overflowed with books and often with students who came to arrange files or to ask advice on school, career, and life, unquote. I enjoyed sharing memories of him with his wife Anne and his four children at a luncheon reception held after his funeral service at the Hotel Bethlehem, not far from the Lehigh campus. Many in attendance told me they remembered the column, and when an open mic was made available for mourners to share their memories, I was pleased to read it aloud. Several of the other speakers did a tremendous job eulogizing Professor Amidon with fond remembrances and humor. I particularly liked a Methodist pastor named Barbara Lee, who shared that she'd enrolled in one of Amidon's freshman seminars not knowing of his conservative political bent. After two lectures, she felt compelled to seek him out to voice her displeasure. Quote, by then, he had offended all of my feminist sensibilities, unquote, she told the crowd. After patiently listening to her ideological complaints, Amidon said simply, you've been duped. A conversation ensued, and before she left his company, she'd been offered a job in his office, and she accepted. Quote, I haven't changed my opinions, but I've had to think about things more deeply, unquote, she told the crowd, many of whose members nodded in acknowledgement. When I noted his passing via social media, I received many warm responses, and one stands out. We've lost an icon in memoriam of David C. Amidon, Lehigh urban legend. He'd have liked that. The one-man urban studies department was indeed an urban legend. Unpaid but richly rewarding. Philadelphia Inquirer, June 23rd, 2013. When a federal judge sided recently with two unpaid interns who later sought compensation, he worsened an already bleak employment picture for young Americans. U.S. District Judge William H. Pauley III ruled in favor of two men who worked on the movie Black Swan and then sued Fox Searchlight Pictures for wages. He ruled that it wasn't enough that the two interns received some benefits, quote, such as resume listings, job references, and an understanding of how a production office works, because those benefits were incidental to working in the office like any other employee and were not the result of internships intentionally structured to benefit them, unquote. His decision came just as the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that teen unemployment was at 24.5% in May, more than triple the national jobless rate. Teens are competing with young adults in a search for full-time jobs, and if Pauley's decision eliminates unpaid internships, there will be fewer unpaid opportunities for those who can't find paid summer positions. That would be a shame for the likes of Joshua Belfer, Benjamin Haney, Alexandra Smith, Anthony Mazzarelli, and other talented people who have interned for me over the years without pay. Pauley might accuse me of violating child labor laws, given that Josh first worked for me when he was entering ninth grade at what is now Barack Hebrew Academy, nay, Akiba. His father used to drop him off at my radio studio or sometimes wait in the car. I knew immediately that Josh was wise and mature beyond his years. In no time, I had him archiving old radio shows and fact-checking newspaper columns. We were together 6 years, giving me plenty of fodder to write my most sincere recommendation ever when he applied to Penn, from where he has since graduated and gone on to the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Now Josh worries that forcing companies to pay all their interns could rob others of opportunities like the one he had. quote, I highly doubt you would have brought me on as a high school freshman if you were forced to pay me, he told me. It would have made no sense, and thus I would not have received one of the best learning experiences of my life, unquote. He's right. I could not have paid him, in which case we would both have missed out. Ben Haney agrees. Ben came to me after graduating from St. Joe's Prep and stayed two summers while attending Notre Dame. He's smart, ethical, and earnest. When Ronald Reagan lay in state at the Capitol, Ben jumped in his car and drove down I-95 to pay his respects, providing my radio audience and me with reports all along. Today, he's a real estate developer and part owner of Max Tavern in Old City. In his spare time, he does advance work for GOP candidates. I'm hoping he'll run for office. Like Josh, he finds the ruling ridiculous. Quote, a lot of the relationships I've made in business and politics exist because of connections I made during the internship, he said. In nearly every situation I encounter, I draw on my experiences, unquote. Alexandra Smith told me she has mixed feelings about the recent ruling. Just 2 weeks ago, I was thrilled to see her chatting with Bill O'Reilly on television as the chairwoman of the College Republican National Committee. Years ago, she was invaluable to me when I was writing a book. Quote, you allowed me to participate in meetings and tasks I'm not even sure I would entrust to someone my age today, she told me. You bet big on my competence and abilities as a teenager, and it became my number one priority to try to exceed your expectations every time, unquote. Alex knows a thing or two about internships. She worked in 9 of them during 4 years at Catholic University. Quote, in the course of 8 semesters and 3 summers, I only took 2 internships that were unpaid because I felt that their value far outweighed whatever small compensation I could receive elsewhere, she said. Still, both of these internships were tough decisions for me financially. I had to plan far in advance in terms of my own personal savings and contributions from family to make them happen, unquote. Then there's Maz. Anthony Mazzarelli is the Senior Vice President of Operations and Deputy Chief Medical Officer at Cooper University Healthcare. But back in 2000, he was a 25-year-old medical student at Robert Wood Johnson and a law student at Penn. He wanted to intern in my law practice. I wanted him involved in radio. Our compromise? Both. Like the others, he has many memories. Quote, I remember the first time that you had me on air, he said. There was a press conference about a local fire department that was getting heat for having a woman pose on a fire truck. I went to the press conference with my high school backpack, but asked questions along with the press corps. You were very happy with me because my questions cornered the guy a bit, and I remember the pride you had in me for pulling it off. I was hooked at that point, unquote. Josh, Ben, Alex, and Maz all told me they were grateful, but I was quick to disabuse them of any notion that I'm responsible for their success. After all, they came to me unsolicited as strangers. My role was simply to channel their ambition and compensate them with the currency of experience. That served us all well. When I asked Maz to remind me of the span of his internship, he quickly emailed, quote, I started in the fall of 2000, or the spring of 2001. As far as an end date, does it ever end? None of your former interns will ever stop being your interns, nor will you stop mentoring them, unquote. True, but now as friends and equals. I've changed my mind. A year after publishing this column, I rethought the issue and decided to start paying my interns. No one is getting rich working for me. What I pay is more beer money than salary, but it no longer felt right to have students spend weeks or months working for experience alone. Maybe I was shamed into my about face. One of our sons worked one summer in Hollywood for the legendary television producer Mike Robin on the set of Major Crimes, and even though my son offered to work for free, the show paid him, providing a greater sense of self-worth. My radio studio is a skeletal operation consisting of just one producer, TC, and me, and while it costs the show a few bucks, I like the new order. I find that the interns now feel better about their contribution, and I like the added responsibility that it's imposed by a paid arrangement. I no longer feel that I'm asking for a favor when I give an assignment. Instead, I'm handing someone a task for which I have a certain high expectation. Don't misunderstand, I'm not advocating for any hard and fast rule when it comes to paying interns. I'm sure there are many situations where experience is the only form of payment available, but my small shop is not one of them. Pensbury grad makes a splash in D.C. Philadelphia Inquirer, October 27, 2013. When in the midst of the government shutdown, President Obama decided to summon leading conservative journalists to an off-the-record White House meeting, he gathered the usual suspects. Fox News contributor and syndicated columnist Charles Krauthammer, syndicated columnist Kathleen Parker, Washington Examiner columnist Byron York, and Paul Jagot, editorial page editor of the Wall Street Journal. And sitting directly to the president's right in the Roosevelt Room for the 90-minute exchange was a 27-year-old Bucks County native, Robert Costa. Costa is Washington editor of the National Review and a contributor to CNBC. But just 10 years ago, he was a suburban public school class president and architect of one of our area's most celebrated rites of passage, the Pensbury Prom. Quote, "So many proms today become these almost antiseptic affairs in a hotel ballroom and just kind of bland and boring and corporate, but Pensbury has it in the gym, and this school has been around since the 60s, Costa explained to me recently. "A lot of people joke it looks like a prison, but it's our prison. And in Levittown, Pennsylvania, the whole community comes together and puts up posters and puts up decorations and makes the whole school transform," unquote. So rich is the tradition that Sports Illustrated senior writer Michael Bamberger used the event as the backdrop for his 2004 American Graffiti-esque work of nonfiction, Wonderland, A Year in the Life of an American High School. And Costa, who as junior class president was charged with coordinating the senior prom, was one of Bamberger's favorite subjects. Wonderland is replete with Costa tales of ambition, ranging from his pursuit of John Mayer to perform at the prom to corralling a parking space at school despite his lack of both car and license. 10 years ago, Bamberger wrote of Costa that he was, quote, "well-connected and unusually sharp. He always seemed a step ahead of everybody else," unquote. Today, they're saying the same thing on Capitol Hill. Quote, "Bob was a force of nature then and remains so. But you'd never know it, so unassuming is he," Bamberger told me last week. "Bob is everything I think a reporter should be, most notably, a good listener. I don't think of him as a conservative journalist. I think of him as a good reporter, one who could wind up doing anything," unquote. Costa, a music aficionado, began his journalism career writing reviews of local concerts for the Bucks County Courier-Times. By day, he would read daily announcements over the PA system and appear on student-run television, PHS-TV. By night, he would attend shows in the Philadelphia area. When his attempts at landing mayor for the 2003 prom didn't pan out, he quote-unquote settled for mayor's then-opening act, Maroon 5. The Los Angeles band was just on the cusp of national stardom. Post-Pensbury, Costa attended Notre Dame, where he ran the school TV station and wrote for the campus newspaper. He then landed a fellowship at the Wall Street Journal editorial page before leaving for Cambridge, where he obtained a master's degree studying Winston Churchill. After Cambridge, it was the National Review, where he has worked for the last 4 years. In high school, he might have been voted least likely to end up working for a leading conservative outlet. In Wonderland, Bamberger recounts how Costa traveled to Ed Rendell's inauguration in Harrisburg amid a busload of Revolutionary War reenactors, whereupon he buttonholed the new governor and offered his own blessing. Quote, "Make us proud, Ed," unquote. But his real hero, wrote Bamberger, was President Clinton, whom Costa traveled to Trenton to meet the day after the prom using his PHS-TV press credential for admittance. Quote, "Mr. President, I'm Bob Costa from Pensbury High," he said, adding, "I'm a young Democrat," unquote, to which the president replied, quote, "That's what you should be," unquote. Costa told me recently the prospect of his classmates going off to war in Iraq and Afghanistan affected his views. Quote, "That experience unsettled me," he said, "and for a few years my politics drifted to the left," unquote. Costa credits Representative Mike Fitzpatrick, Republican of Pennsylvania, for whom he interned when Fitzpatrick was a county commissioner, with his interest in conservatism and registration as a Republican. Quote, "These days I'm a reporter first and last, and keep my opinions to myself," Costa says. "I don't have an agenda. Temperamentally and personally, sure, I'm conservative, but that's not what drives me. I love covering politics and talking politics, and I'm happy to leave the editorializing to the columnists and bloggers," unquote. When Obama was sworn in for his second term in January, Costa was in the front row, sporting a National Review credential. Nearby, none other than John Mayer on the arm of Katy Perry. Costa was quick to reintroduce himself to the music superstar as, quote, "Bob Costa, Pensbury High," unquote. See, though Costa's efforts to land Mayer at Pensbury in his junior year hadn't panned out, he did persuade Mayer to play at his senior prom the following year, which explains Mayer's response at the inauguration, quote, "I'm not surprised to see you here," unquote. Neither, I'm sure, is anyone from Pensbury High, class of 2004. I didn't put it in the initial column, but I get a real kick out of the fact that, according to Costa, his father used to drive him to school listening to me doing morning drive, pre-syndication, and Sirius XM in Philadelphia. I'd like to think that some of his appetite for current events discourse was shaped on those rides. Since I wrote this column, he has left the National Review and joined the Washington Post. He also makes frequent television appearances through his affiliations with both NBC and MSNBC and is a regular on Meet the Press. Today, Robert Costa is one of the most influential political journalists in America, as evidenced by the role he played in the 2016 presidential race. Costa's name was in the byline on any number of front-page stories for the Post that evidenced his unparalleled access to the critical players. 2 months out from Election Day on September 15, he wrote a prominent story revealing that Donald Trump remained, quote, "unwilling to say that President Obama was born in the United States," unquote. This came in an interview Costa conducted aboard Trump's private jet while it idled on a tarmac in Canton, Ohio. When 1 month from Election Day, the now infamous Billy Bush Access Hollywood grab 'em by the pee tape surfaced, who did Trump talk to on October 8 to announce he was staying in the race? Costa, of course. Quote, "I'd never withdraw. I'd never withdraw in my life. No, I'm not quitting this race," unquote, Trump told the Pensbury grad. Just 2 days before Election Day, the Post gave great prominence to a lengthy Costa piece detailing his 350-mile trek across his native Pennsylvania. And finally, on election night, via his Twitter feed that reaches around 150,000, Costa gave unique insight into what was transpiring inside the Trump Tower. Quote, "On the phone with Giuliani, he just left Trump's apartment, said Trump is watching everything even though I'm telling him not to, drinking Diet Coke," unquote. And Giuliani thought about bringing platters of Italian food, but decided against it. He always sticks with the hamburgers anyway, unquote. For anyone else writing front page stories for the Washington Post about a presidential election or detailing the inner workings of a president-elect suite would cap a long career. But for the barely 31-year-old Costa, it's still just the beginning. In 2017, Costa was named the new moderator of PBS's Washington Week, succeeding Gwen Ifill, who passed away the previous November. Nightmare on Health Site. Philadelphia Inquirer, December 1, 2013. I'm in healthcare purgatory. Since sunrise on the day of the launch, October 1, I've attempted to shop for health insurance at healthcare.gov. Almost 8 weeks later, I still haven't been successful in accessing quotes online for insurance. My experience has been a Kafkaesque nightmare of internet denial and telephone roadblocks. And this is not some journalistic folly. I'm in the market for health insurance and have been optimistic about my ability to get a competitive rate as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Here's the most frustrating part. Apparently, there is a competitive rate for my family and me, but I haven't been able to examine it. For the first few weeks, I couldn't even gain access to the site. I would log on to the web address with no result. The screen was all white space with no information. Then one day, eureka. I got to the homepage, was greeted by the smiling face of the woman whose image has become synonymous with the site, and led to her allegedly being cyberbullied. After inputting my home state of Pennsylvania, I was at least able to access an application. But when I was next asked for a username and password, the screen froze. Trying again later, I could get to a page that asked me to provide the answers to three security questions, only my screen didn't show me the questions. I tried every conceivable way of getting beyond that step. It occurred to me that the answers were what was important, not the questions, so I tried providing consistent answers to questions I'd never seen. No dice. A few days later, voila, the questions appeared. I was elated, but no closer to results. That's because my next roadblock came when it was time to finalize my application. Data that I repeatedly inputted would not save. I was back to square one. Finally, I called the toll-free number and walked through my application with an operator who told me she was in Texas. It took about 45 minutes for me to cover the basics, all of my personal information, and that of my wife and three sons. Our daughter will be 26 in the spring and no longer able to be carried on our plan. This was a non-intrusive, cursory Q&A, except for a question about tobacco usage that did not differentiate between cigars and cigarettes, a distinction that has been recognized by my insurers in the past. After receiving my information, the operator told me that there were 9 plans available for me. I was ecstatic and began to scribble notes, quote, Independence Blue Cross / Keystone HMO plan for $1,926 per month, $6K out of pocket, $0 deductible, $15 per visit copay, $5 prescription. Slightly more, Independence Blue Cross PPO plan. Can pay half that for far less protection, unquote. She assured me that all the information I had provided would be merged with my online endeavors through my Social Security number just as soon as the bugs were out of the website. Then I would be able to go online and review all 9 plans available to me. Great news. Except that a few days later, when I could finally access the website, none of the data I had provided over the phone was on my application. I had to start over. Again. Okay, I thought, with the website up and running, it will take me half the time to input the data on my computer that it took me to do so through the operator. Spelling S-M-E-R-C-O-N-I-S-H was a fatiguing process for both of us. So again, I inputted all of the data for our family, at the end of which I was asked to electronically verify my signature. There was no instruction provided on how to do this. When I finally figured out that it meant simply typing in my name, too bad it didn't say so, my application was not accepted. Why not? Apparently because all of my attempts at accessing healthcare.gov left the computer model convinced I was a fraud. To which I say, if any crook invests this amount of time in impersonating me, he's entitled to my health insurance. Now it was back to the toll-free number, whereupon an operator told me that I should send a copy of my passport or my driver's license so that my identity could be confirmed. Huh? I protested, noting that would mean a several-day turnaround. The alternative, I was told, was uploading an image of either document to the website. I did, and was told they'd be in touch. One day later, I logged onto my still, quote-unquote, pending application and was greeted with this message, quote, you have a notice available about your identity verification, unquote. This was yet another reminder of the poor design of the website. Were I dealing with Amazon or Orbitz, that, quote-unquote, notice would have been embedded in the message itself. No such luck here. Instead, there was only an X off to the side, so I clicked it. Guess what? The message went away, and so did my ability to try to figure out what it was. Now it was back to the toll-free number, where I was told to expect an email explanation. None has arrived. Out of curiosity, I asked whether she had a record of my prior calls. She did. 6. Wrong again. The number is double that. Most frustrating is to think there are 9 different plans for me to consider. If only I could see them. Especially because mental health is covered. And about now, I'm in need of some. The week after writing this column, I published a follow-up in which I wrote, quote, "This past week I broke the logjam. The key was using a new feature on the website that allowed me to remove my existing applications. Then, using a new email address, I started from scratch. The process was not intrusive. I provided background information of the name, rank, and serial number variety. And after just 20 minutes, I was looking at 24 offerings from Independence Blue Cross and Aetna. Not bad, especially considering that Pennsylvania did not set up its own exchange. The plans are grouped into 4 categories depending on the total cost of the coverage they offer: bronze, silver, gold, and platinum. I needed coverage for a family of 5. My current plan, provided via my affiliation with the Klein & Spector law firm, is an IBX personal choice that costs $2,246.90 with 0 deductible and no out-of-pocket maximum, so long as we stay within the network. That plan includes our daughter," unquote. The plan my family settled on was pretty much the same as our old plan through the Klein & Spector law firm. While mindful of and concerned about the escalating costs of the plan since I bought it, I was nevertheless able to experience a Travelocity-like market for the purchase of private health insurance, as President Obama had promised. Secret Facet of Westboro Case, Philadelphia Inquirer, March 9, 2014. Quote, "My case made the national spotlight. There are almost 1 million articles on the internet, and I have done interviews across the world, but they won't tell you the real story. Up until this point, I have kept the truth to myself, my legal team, some family, and close friends," unquote. So read a handwritten letter I received nearly a year ago from Al Snyder, a man I had come to know and admire for his courageous legal battle against the Westboro Baptist Church. Snyder sued Westboro after church representatives protested at his son's military funeral. Marine Lance Corporal Matthew A. Snyder was just 20 years old when he died in a one-vehicle Humvee accident in Iraq on March 3, 2006, just 5 weeks after his deployment. A half-dozen Westboro members picketed Matthew Snyder's funeral at a Roman Catholic church in Maryland 1 week later. That none of his protesters had any personal knowledge of Matthew or his family didn't stop them from parading signs saying, "America is doomed, fag troops, priests rape boys, and semper fi fags." For calling his son gay and disrupting the funeral, Al Snyder fought Westboro all the way to the Supreme Court without publicly revealing a secret, that he himself is gay. Only now has Snyder decided to tell his story, an extended version of which I just authored for Politico magazine. Initially keeping the matter a secret was a decision Al Snyder made with his partner of more than a decade, Walt Fisher. According to Al, it was actually Walt who never wanted to make the lawsuit about their sexuality. Quote, "When we first started talking about it, I couldn't see where it would hurt," Al told me recently. "I remember saying to Walt, I don't think people are really going to care about that. And he said, what it's going to do is make this a gay issue, and it's not. He was right," unquote. Snyder might never have sued Westboro had the church's bad behavior been limited to picketing the funeral. But not long after burying his son, Al discovered an online screed written by a Westboro member titled "The Burden of Matthew Snyder," containing vile assertions about the way he and his wife had raised their son. Quote, "God blessed you, Mr. and Mrs. Snyder, with a resource, and his name was Matthew. He was an arrow in your quiver. In thanks to God for the comfort the child could bring you, you had a duty to prepare that child to serve the Lord, his God, period. You did just the opposite. You raised him for the devil," unquote. That's when Al contacted 2 lawyers in central Pennsylvania, Sean Summers and Craig Trebielcock, who agreed to file his case. Quote, "You see, this wasn't just a father fighting a gay hate group. This is about a gay father fighting for the dignity and respect of my son, a father who hid the fact that he was gay from the media and the public, unquote, Al wrote to me last year. Summers and Trebilcock were successful in keeping Al's sexuality out of the case and benefited from rulings by District Judge Richard Bennett, an appointee of President George W. Bush, which precluded the questioning of Al about his lifestyle. While Al knows now that Westboro learned he was homosexual during the litigation, that information was never made known to the jury. It was not something he had kept from his only son. Matthew had known of his father's sexuality since he was 14, when he'd asked Al about his relationship with the man he called, quote, Mr. Walt, unquote. Al told his son the truth. While accepting his father's reality, Matthew quickly affirmed his own attraction to girls. Al Snyder sued Westboro, content in the knowledge that Matthew would have wanted him to do so. When able to write from his basic training at Parris Island, South Carolina, he'd be sure to extend greetings to Fisher. Quote, I'm getting used to the yelling already. I'm looking forward to being a Marine. I love you. Tell Mr. Walt I said hi. Unquote. Despite the intense interest of national media in a proceeding that revolved around homophobic slurs, the relationship between Al and Walt remained a secret from the media and public through the first trial and the subsequent appeals. Not even the justices of the Supreme Court could have known that when the case was argued on October 6, 2010, seated in the chambers amid family members were partners Al and Walt. By then, Walt was walking with a cane, having been told he was suffering rheumatoid arthritis, for which he was receiving physical therapy. Soon, he would be diagnosed instead with small cell carcinoma. Al Snyder lost his Supreme Court case on March 2, 2011, in an 8-1 decision, and lost Walt Fisher 2 months later. 3 years later, the vitriol directed at Al Snyder continues. Last December, Snyder discovered a hateful online Westboro posting that made reference to Walt, the first public mention that Al has ever seen to the relationship. Quote, all this while he moved in with his housemate, a simpering, swishing, queer as a $3 bill, open fag, unquote. Today, Al Snyder doesn't regard the entire experience so much as a coming out for him, but rather a coming out for Westboro. Quote, I lost my battle in the U.S. Supreme Court, but in the end, won the war with the American people and the U.S. lawmakers. The lawsuit did what I hoped it would do. It brought this hate group out to the public, unquote. Sometimes columns beget columns. This is a great example. By the time I caught up with attorney Craig Trebilcock to discuss Al Snyder's story, he was now Judge Craig Trebilcock of the York County, Pennsylvania Court of Common Pleas. He is also a U.S. Army Reserve colonel who had just served nearly a year in Afghanistan with the Judge Advocate General Corps, where he was director of the rule of law for the commander of Afghanistan. After we'd finished speaking about Al Snyder, he said, when you're finished with this story, I have another for you, something that deserves attention. And he delivered. Judge Trebilcock turned me on to the Veterans Treatment Courts, which I wrote about in my column of April 27, 2014. The courts, which began operating in 2008, were the brainchild of Judge Robert T. Russell, Jr., who sits on the city court in Buffalo. It was Russell who saw and acted on the need after noticing an increase in the number of veterans appearing on his drug and mental health dockets. His reasoning was that veterans entangled in the justice system should appear in front of judges with a unique understanding of their problems. Trebilcock himself presides at one of the veterans treatment courts, and he shared with me the case of Justin Slesser, a success story. When he lost his access to prescription pain meds, Slesser had turned to heroin and a life of crime. After being drummed out of the military, he built a rap sheet and lost his marriage. Luckily for him, help arrived in the form of Veterans Treatment Court. Slesser worked with an attorney and veterans outreach officer to get his legal troubles consolidated. He received substance abuse counseling in West Virginia and then entered a program for post-traumatic stress disorder. He graduated from that veterans treatment program and is now employed and clean. Quote, without the veterans court, I'd probably be dead, unquote, Slesser told me. And when I told Slessor's story on my radio program, I was overwhelmed with reaction from veterans eager to share their stories of injury, opioid dependence, and in some cases, heroin addiction. For those interested in learning more about this important subject, I recommend Justice for Vets, a nonprofit whose senior director is Melissa Fitzgerald, a Philly girl who's doing good for veterans after a successful acting career, which included playing Carol on The West Wing. SATs don't always mark a successful path. Philadelphia Inquirer, March 16, 2014. I just experienced the thrill of being invited back to the campus of my alma mater to speak to undergraduate students. The invitation came a few months ago from Jack Luhl, the chair of journalism and communication at Lehigh University, from which I graduated in 1984. That someone in Luhl's position would think students could benefit from listening to me for an hour gave me a measure of achievement and acceptance. And I get why I was invited. The combination of my professional activities since graduation, including writing for the Inquirer, hosting a daily radio program nationwide on Sirius XM, writing 5 books with a novel on the way, and now hosting a Saturday morning program on CNN. There's just one problem. According to my SATs, I was never Lehigh material. Here are the bare facts. At Hollycong Junior High School and thereafter at Central Bucks West High School, I was a sometimes honor roll student. My grades were mostly B's with an infrequent A and an occasional C, frankly more of the latter than the former. In a scrapbook somewhere, I've got a few clippings from the Intelligencer listing the most recent honor roll with my name mentioned. My public school record included some other attributes: sports participation, a few class presidencies, a stint as newspaper editor, and some liabilities, such as when I was disciplined for selling fake IDs to classmates. What can I say? I was always entrepreneurial, the kid who sold you Christmas cards and came to shovel your drive. Sometimes that ambition got me in trouble, such as when Coach Carey demanded I stop an NFL betting pool out of homeroom, or when I got thrown in a police van at the Spectrum for selling Genesis bumper stickers in my senior year. They cost me a nickel to print, and I sold them for a buck. My SATs were never commensurate with my respectable school grades, and it was no one-off. I took the test several times and never batted above the Mendoza line. 990. I still hate seeing it numerically represented. 990. I never even broke 1,000. Lucky for me that my father received his master's from Lehigh and my brother was president of his Lehigh class the year I was applying. Otherwise, I'm sure my SATs would have sunk my application. Driving back to Bethlehem Tuesday, I felt like George Bailey on the bridge toward the end of It's a Wonderful Life when an angel shows the Jimmy Stewart character an alternative path. Bailey's angel was named Clarence. Mine was Samuel Missimer, then Lehigh's Dean of Admissions, who admitted me despite my mediocre SATs. What if my college acceptance had been determined by that test? A rejection would have meant that I'd never have met a faculty member named Dave Amidon who sparked in me an academic fire I never knew existed. Missing from the Lehigh campus in the fall of 1980, I would not have met quote-unquote Ambassador George Herbert Walker Bush when he toured Bethlehem Steel, an event that led to my working for Vice President Bush and a string of extraordinary political experiences, which in turn caused media outlets to solicit my commentary. No Lehigh, no Amidon. No Amidon, no double major, and no Phi Beta Kappa. No Phi Beta Kappa, no admission to Penn Law. The intervening years haven't softened my antipathy toward the SAT, not even the recent experience of a son who aced it. I'm encouraged that the College Board is attempting to change the nature of the exam in a way that will recognize evidence-based thinking that students should be gleaning in high school. Perhaps if I'd had an exam like the board now contemplates, I'd have scored more respectably. But maybe not. Better for students, parents, and colleges to scrap it all together. Today, out of roughly 2,800 four-year U.S. colleges and universities, about 850 make SAT or ACT submissions optional. A recent study by two former colleagues at Bates College, William Hiss, the former dean of admissions, and Valerie Wilson Franks, the study's lead investigator, found that there is a negligible difference between the performance of students who submit test results and those who do not. The study, called Defining Promise, Optional Standardized Testing Policies in American College and University Admissions, looked at 123,000 students and alumni records. It found only a 0.05 differential between the GPAs of those applicants who submitted